covering some similar ground from a different perspective is my next guest, Dr. Sebastian Gayrica, who's Deputy Director of the Climate and Energy Finance Group at Otago University, specialises in climate finance. He's on the line now. Kia ora, Guy. Sebastian.
Kia ora, Brian. Thank you for having me on.
Nice to have you on. And now, first off, just exactly what does climate finance mean in practice?
Sorry, I think you cut out for a second there. So climate finance, or, you know, more broadly, what I like to study and teach, I would call sustainable finance. And it's essentially exploring the risks and opportunities around issues like climate change and social inequality, incorporating those risks and opportunities into our financial system and how that can be done and what those risks and opportunities are.
Does that mean things like the triple bottom line, which I've heard of before, where you have a also, as well as your profits and losses, you also have an environmental impact which you factor into the accounting, the bookkeeping you do with a business?
Yeah, for sure. So that's around sort of the carbon liability of a company's activities and then costing that into your profit and loss. But it goes far beyond that. So, you know, you can look at areas like investments where there's significant risks that climate change and all the effects that that brings on our environment and businesses, incorporating that into your investment decisions. Also around how you actually structure financing in order to promote more sustainable business practices and investments. Modeling those risks and opportunities.
Would it be fair to say, Sebastian, that New Zealand's on the cusp, as many nations are, perhaps in entering a new era where we really do start to pay a meaningful amount for the carbon that we emit, and maybe also we earn a meaningful amount for the carbon we stick in sinks?
Yes, definitely. So out of various climate finance policies, I would call them, one element of that is pricing. So there you can have either what you've described as an emissions trading scheme, like we have in New Zealand, like we have in Europe. China's trialing various iterations of that. And the emissions trading scheme essentially makes emitters pay for carbon and lets sequesterers, such as permanent forests or other sequestration technologies, earn some monetary payback for sequestering that carbon. On the other side, you would have a carbon tax, which some countries have implemented, where for every ton of CO2 equivalent, so carbon dioxide equivalent, various other gases are converted to carbon dioxide, are priced or taxed. So you have a fixed cost, whereas in the emissions trading scheme, the price is set by supply and demand in the market.
I was mentioning earlier that, and I'd noticed how inflation has reached a high of highest for about a decade. And that made me think, if we start to pay, as we are beginning to now, what's the price of carbon per tonne at the moment to emit a tonne of carbon into the atmosphere in New Zealand? It's about $50, am I right?
No, in New Zealand it's actually gone up to about $64 today, I believe.
Really? It's trending up. It was $50 not too long ago, wasn't it, a tonne?
Yeah, so at the last carbon credit auction, so the government actually auctions off these credits now, which is a vast improvement to what we used to do in the past, but now a whole chunk of these are auctioned off into the market. And the government, or the ETS, actually had what we call a cost containment reserve. So once that price at the auction hit $50, an additional, I believe, 7 million credits were released into the market to try and keep the cost down so that the effect on business is minimized. But that's been sort of blown out now, and we're at a price of, like I said, $64. Now, I believe that's still actually too low when we're talking about the cost that these emissions actually have on our globe and society. And so this social cost of carbon has actually been estimated, you know, from anywhere of $150 up to some maybe less reliable studies going all the way up to $10,000 a ton.
Different countries exact a different price. Am I right in saying, because I got a text sending this earlier, that Sweden charges around about $200 a ton?
I'm not sure about Sweden, sorry, but I think they might actually have a tax rather than emissions
right,
trading.
Right, okay.
But certainly different countries have different prices. So the EU emissions trading scheme has their own price. And that was actually a big issue in the early days of the New Zealand's emissions trading scheme, because we were import-export market under the Kyoto Protocol, and there were some international units that I would argue were maybe not ideal, that were selling for, you know, $1 or $2 a credit or a ton of CO2. So if you look at the historical prices of New Zealand's emissions trading scheme units, that was, for a while there, it was down at about $2. Then the New Zealand government decided to close our market off to the international market, and that price shot up quickly to about $25, where we used to have sort of, you could go to the government and pay them $25 and get a credit. There was a different type of price ceiling that we used to have there. But yeah, again, now that's those regulations around the ETS have gladly, well, I'm glad that they've changed and the price is going up. But I think there's still vast room for improvement there as well.
$64. What do you think then?
Yes.
And okay, you're just one person, but you're a person who studied this a lot more than I have. Would be a reasonable price per ton in New Zealand?
What? A reasonable price? I think, you know, I believe the government in their, when they do their project analysis now, they include what we call a shadow carbon price. So they add in this social cost of carbon. And I believe the price they're using is between 170 and 240 New Zealand dollars. And that was described by the Climate Change Commission report. So I think, you know, something closer to that would be a fair price, well, a fairer price now. But again, we're trending in the right direction. The government's got a couple of consultations out around changing some of the mechanisms within the emissions trading scheme, which I believe if they are, those issues are fixed properly, then we will probably see the price go up further.
It's going to be inflationary, isn't it? I mean, because we rely so much on the energy we get from fossil fuel, if we have to pay a lot more per ton for the amount of carbon going up when we burn it into the atmosphere, that's going to have an impact on inflation, a significant impact, isn't it?
I mean, that's maybe more a question for an economics professor, but I see your point. I think that would be a sort of a short-term effect, but the long-term effect and the goal we're trying to get to is that we're trying to incentivize the sequestration and reduction of emissions, and we're trying to disincentivize emissions. So actually, the higher the price, the better for our climate change ambitions, even though there may be a short-term cost to certain parts of our economy. But often those are the parts of our economy that have benefited from this negative externality for many years, right? They've never had to pay a price on emissions. Now they do.
Another possible impact, looking in the other direction, it sinks, and there's been a fair amount of discussion about this, is that people will simply plant pines and soak up the carbon that way. And people worry about parts of our hill country getting plastered in pines, or that has happened before when logging, there have been various logging booms. Is that an issue for you? Do you see that as being a likely consequence of a rising carbon price?
Oh, for sure. And that's something we're already seeing happen, right? And when I submitted to the Climate Change Commission report, one of the main things I said was that we need to restructure some of these incentives around what type of sequestration we want to incentivize and not. I don't want to see New Zealand covered in pine forests, and it seems to be going that way. I've seen examples of, you know, good pastoral land being converted into pine forests. And, you know, I live on a lifestyle block out here that was a pine forest, I believe, 70 years ago, and I still have to deal to that soil because of all those, you know, pine trees acidify the soil, and so growing other things thereafter is a problem as well. And again, we don't just want to see pine trees everywhere. But I think there are solutions to that.
Yeah, what are they?
Yeah, so, you know, these are solutions that I think about a little bit, and, you know, in terms of whether they've been fully proven, I'd say. But one idea is to have sort of, you could think of it as almost another credit for native sequestration, right? So if you're planting diverse permanent native forests, that you can sell another credit alongside your NZU or emissions trading scheme credit, which in companies that want to offset their emissions are likely to want to offset with better quality sequestration, right? So you can then earn a premium for planting native forests rather than pine forests. I think another solution may be, again, changing those mechanisms, or maybe limiting the amount of pine forests that you're allowed to use, especially because if we look forward, say you plant a pine forest now, you look ahead, you know, you'll be harvesting that idea, you know, hopefully in 25 years usually. By that time, the carbon price might be so high that there's no point in actually harvesting the timber because you'll have to surrender some credits back. And there may be an economic case then to just leave the pine forest there. And then we're going to end up with all these permanent pine forests. And there is something I'm working on. I won't disclose too much, but I'm working on with a startup at the moment, looking at different options for these sort of, especially these small lot forestry holdings. But yeah, more on that maybe another time.
You're listening to Nights on RNZ National. I'm speaking to Dr. Sebastian Gayrecker. He is a specialist in climate finance. He's from Otago University. Now, it's interesting you talk about native forest as being a sink. Now, I had Dean Bagent-Mercer from Forest and Bird on not too long ago, talking about the impact that pests might be having on the ability for native forest to act as a carbon sink. I'm talking about possums and goats and deer and pigs. In fact, so much so that maybe they don't work as a sink. And I'm wondering, well, how much guesswork is involved in determining how much carbon has been absorbed by or released by plants?
Now we're going, I think, a little bit beyond my expertise. So that's the sort of information I would take from experts in those areas to then come up with the, you know, financial economic feasibility of these approaches, right?
It does matter, though, because if we're wrong, I mean, if a forest is not acting as a sink and we think it is, then, I mean, that's, in the end, if we're putting so much store in sinks to get us out of this hole that we're in and they're not actually acting as sinks, or the margin for error is too great, then that could be catastrophic in the long term.
Oh, yeah, it's a massive issue if that's the case, right? And that is a risk that you have to incorporate when you look at these sort of solutions. And I think the main key here is that sequestration through planting trees is only one small part of the solution, right? This is a massive, complex problem. We can't rely on sequestration. And again, in the Climate Change Commission report, you know, I think there was a over-reliance there on planting forests. I think we need to reduce our emissions first.
And the main way of doing that, and this brings me to another issue, and that is methane and dairying, because that's a big source of greenhouse gases
oh, yeah.
in this country. And you will be well aware of the arguments, and you probably even work with farmers on this in terms of, well, what about my global competitiveness? I might pay for this, and my dairy farm is now not as competitive as one on the other side of the world, but are they actually bothering in the same way that I am? What's your answer to farmers who worry about that?
Well, first of all, I would like to say there's ways to do farming, I believe, and from experts I've talked to at Ag Otago, there's ways of doing farming that are both just as, if not more profitable because of a better product, and because overseas importers, so our export market, they are going to value sustainable agricultural products more and more as time passes. And there's a way to do farming where you actually don't have to have a lot of emissions. So you do no-till regenerative farming type approaches. And those can be in dairy or they can be more diversified approaches.
Another issue in the South Island, this is something that Patrick Phelps mentioned a few chats back with me, and that is the impact of the fact that a lot of processing in the South Island relies on coal. A lot of dairying, the heat that you need to use to get the moisture out of the milk so you can turn it into powder and export it overseas without spending so much on transport costs, needs coal in the South Island. Gas isn't available. At the moment, he's right, isn't he?
Oh, very correct. But I think, again, that's one of the main issues that we face, right? And again, bringing those emissions down is what we need to do. I think the ETS helps with that. You might be aware that currently agriculture is not included in the ETS, even though it makes up 48% of our domestic emissions. So I think, you know, I know there's work being done around sustainable agriculture, but I don't really understand, and maybe this is something I need to spend more time on, why agriculture has not yet been included in the emissions trading scheme. They are essentially getting a free ride still on those emissions.
Well, maybe because the government, various governments, worry that dairying is not as competitive, then we lose a lot in export earnings.
For sure, and that's a very sort of single... single approach way of thinking about it, right? Why do we have to only do dairy or mainly do dairy? Why can't we convert some of these farms to produce other products? We have fantastic fertile land in New Zealand and other countries around the world with less land and less fertile land aren't relying purely on one export product, right?
When you crunch the numbers, Sebastian, as I'm guessing you do, in terms of what a business faces based on a certain price for carbon. Do you see there being initially, maybe it doesn't, not forever, but initially as we, because of the signals we're trying to give ourselves to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, prices will go up. Do you see that hurdle being quite a challenge? And some businesses saying, look, to the government, this is going to put us out. We can't sustain this. And also the issue of people revolting against perhaps the price of fuel for their cars, because most people use cars in this country, going up so much that it really starts to cut into their well-being, into their welfare. These are real issues that the government will have to deal with as we try and wean ourselves off carbon.
For sure. But I think one of the key words you use there is a sustainable business, right? I mean, how can you say you've run a sustainable business so far where you haven't had to pay for your emissions that we now know have these real impacts on the whole world, which are actually going to be financial as well? And I'd love to talk about that maybe a bit more as well. You know, how can you say that when you've had this, what I call a free ride on your emissions, and now that you actually have to start paying for them, now your business is not feasible anymore? Well, then is your business really sustainable? Right. And that, you know, these changes are going to come with some serious costs and effects on businesses and people, like you said, through fuel prices. But I believe those will be transitory, and it's on the government to help support those people and the people affected by those businesses maybe not being feasible anymore, that they can transition their businesses and their lifestyles to being more sustainable. And the government is trying to come up with more and more of these policies, but these concerns that you raise make it really hard, I think, for policymakers to have aggressive policy, which is what we need. I recently had one of the EU ambassadors visit my class down in Otago, and you know, she said we have two political cycles to get these things written into law, these changes that we need. So we've got about 8 years to really start making changes.
What are those costs that you, again, as somebody with who is specialising in finance, you see us facing if we don't get on top of the carbon issue?
Right. So, you know, this brings me sort of to the more broad conversations, I think, around climate finance rather than focusing on agriculture or forestry. And the costs are massive. So, you know, even just looking at, if we looked at, for example, stranded asset risk. So that's assets that are currently worth something on companies' books or investors' books, but are very likely to be written down to almost nothing in the near future. So in the fossil fuel industry, for example, globally, it's estimated that 82% of oil, 49% of gas, and 82% of coal, 49% of gas, and 33% of oil cannot be burned. So that's those reserves that companies currently have on their balance sheets. So they found this gas, coal, and oil, and it's worth something to their business, but you know, a lot of that cannot be burned. And the cost of that is estimated by this one study to be about $1 to $4 trillion. A trillion is $1,000 billion, or a million.
Unless the various producers in the various nations say individually, to hell with it, we're going to keep burning it anyway because that's the easiest option that we can see.
For sure. And then we've got a whole lot of other problems, which I don't think we, you know, which will lead to even bigger costs. So when we look at climate finance risks, you know, I'm often coming from an investment perspective. We can break those into physical, transition, and liability risks. So the physical risks are things like wildfires, increased hurricanes, sea level rise, those things affecting your real assets. So in New Zealand, there's a real big risk around coastal properties. And that's for everyday New Zealanders, right? South Dunedin here being a prime example of that. So as sea levels rise, eventually these properties either are not going to be inhabitable or need massive investment into infrastructure to protect them. And another problem is they're not going to be insurable. So that's sort of on your physical risk. Also, of course, if we have more wildfires, droughts, those all affect our economic productivity. Then in the transition risk, we've got policy, right? So like an emissions trading scheme coming in, all of a sudden you have to pay for your emissions, that's a cost for you. Or you know, other transition risks that are related to policy, or you know, renewable energies are now cheaper for producing electricity than using fossil fuels. So those coal-fired plants, for example, that were projected to be running for the next 20 to 30 years are going to be shut down a lot sooner due to policy changes and actually the cheaper cost of renewable energy. And then you've got liability risks, which is on one side is lawsuits. So there's a massive amount of climate litigation happening around the world where companies are getting, and governments actually are getting sued and having to pay out because of the damage they've done to the environment. And then there's the insurance risk. You know, in New Zealand, for example, many of the coastal properties are going to become uninsurable in the next sort of 30 to 50 years. So insurance companies up until then are going to up the price more and more as they see this risk increasing. And they've actually been at the front of this, estimating these risks. And, you know, in 30 to 40 years, a lot of these properties you won't be able to get insurance on, which means you won't be able to get a mortgage, which means the price will tank, right?
Sebastian, we've only got about a minute left, and I want to ask you, sorry about this. What would you like to see come out of COP26, Sebastian, in a minute?
In 1 minute, I mean, from New Zealand, I would like to see a much more ambitious emissions reductions plan and how that actually is going to happen, and various changes to the ETS. Globally, we need a lot more countries, to commit to these emission reduction plans. And I think overall, we can all learn a lot from the European Union, which is really, you know, they've taken a lot of these costs you mentioned earlier and said, that's a cost, but we have to do this. There is no choice. We have two political cycles to make these changes. So they've invested heavily and made massive policy changes throughout, you know, the last sort of 5 years.
Are you optimistic about what's going to happen in Scotland?
Yeah, I am actually. I think, you know, a lot of the world is getting behind this. If we look at the financial industry, about 33% of US assets invested, 50% of New Zealand assets invested, or $50 trillion US dollars globally now have some environmental, social, and governance practices. So investors, the financial industry, they're starting to get behind this. Their clients are getting behind this. So I think, you know, most governments are also getting behind this. So it's a matter of, it's no longer should we do something, it's how can we do it. And that's where everyone is working at this problem.
Sebastian, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
No, thank you so much for having me. And I'd just like to say, if anyone's interested in this work, please Google Climate and Energy Finance Group, Otago.
Thanks, Sebastian. That's Dr. Sebastian Gayrica, Deputy Director of the Climate and Energy Finance Group at Otago University's Business School, specializes in climate finance.